morning's scripture reading is Matthew chapter 15, verses 29 through 31. That's Matthew chapter 15, verses 29 through 31. Jesus departed from there, skirted the Sea of Galilee, and went up on the mountain and sat down there. Then great multitudes came to him, having with them the lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others, and they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel.
It's good to see you this morning. We're glad that you're here. We see many family in visiting with their families who are located here, and we're glad that you all have had the opportunity to be with us. Hope that you have a good holiday season. It helps in any kind of circumstance to find a timeline, to find a circumstance, what is making that circumstance particularly powerful at that particular time. When a crime scene is investigated, the police look not only at the particular event that took place, but what took place leading up to it to try to find motive, to try to find reason for this event that took place. That's on the negative side. On the positive side, when some great act of heroism takes place, people try to look for the political circumstances, the historic circumstances that preceded it, what it led to try to put it in its context and make sense of it. It is hard for me anyway to take just one episode of Jesus' ministry without putting it in an overall context. Here in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus has been crisscrossing the Sea of Galilee, making many people impacted by his great works and by his teachings. Back in Matthew chapter 14, Jesus fed 5,000 men plus women and children with one boy's snack, 5 little loaves of bread and 2 fishes, and the multitudes marveled at this. Then Jesus sent the disciples across the Sea of Galilee on a boat ahead of himself while he sought time to pray. Then, in the middle of the night, he walked on the sea to them. They were amazed. Peter reached out and said, "May I come out to you on the sea?" Jesus led him, but then Peter took his eyes off of Jesus, spiritually speaking, and began to sink. Jesus then chastised him for his little faith. After those two events, there was one of these summary healings in the area of Gennesaret on the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. That is when Matthew 14, verses 34 through 36 records that the people of that place recognized Jesus and sent out into all the surrounding region to get all the sick people and bring them to him in the hopes that they just might touch the hem of his garment. Someone had been healed like that before. In Matthew chapter 9, there was a woman with a flow of blood for 12 years who had just touched the hem of Jesus' garment. Jesus felt the power go out of him, and he turned around and said that her faith had made her well. These people then were gathering the masses so that they might just touch the hem of Jesus' garment. After that, the scribes and Pharisees came to Jesus, and they're upset. They're not happy that he's doing miracles. They try to find fault with him. They're upset that Jesus is allowing his disciples to eat without doing the ceremonial washing that had been prescribed by their forefathers. It was not a part of the law of God they were upset about Jesus' disciples missing. It was a part of their traditions that they had built around the law of God. After that event, when Jesus rebuked them in turn, Jesus travels up north to the region of Tyre and Sidon, where there are a lot of people who aren't even Jews, who really shouldn't even, by all logic, have faith because they don't have the revelation of the Word of God. But he finds there someone who has greater faith than a lot of things that he had seen in Israel. A woman, a Syro-Phoenician woman, a woman from Syria in the land of Phoenicia, a woman in this region, a Gentile, who has a daughter who is severely demon-possessed. Jesus heals her daughter at her request and mentions that she has great faith. There was one other time that Jesus mentioned the great faith of an individual, and that was for a Gentile as well. Jesus said to the centurion who had his servant healed in Matthew chapter 10, "I have not found such," or Matthew chapter 8, verse 10, "I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." That's as far as we've gotten so far in our study. After Jesus is in the region of Tyre and Sidon and heals that Gentile's daughter and compliments her faith, he comes down a little bit to the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee, if we take this account and Mark's into consideration. Mark records one specific miracle that Jesus worked at that particular time, but Matthew records that there was a lot going on at that time, as Joshua just read for us. He skirted the Sea of Galilee, went up on a mountain, and sat down there. The people started bringing to him the lame, the blind, the mute, and many others, and he laid them down at Jesus' feet. The multitude then marveled, the record says, when they saw the mute speaking. People who had never spoken a word in their lives and became adults, all of a sudden were able to communicate with perfect articulation and language. The people marveled when they saw the maimed made whole. People who did not have limbs or portions of limbs suddenly had the portions of limbs restored, the language indicates. The people marveled when they saw the lame. People who had been without the ability to walk for years or maybe all of their lives suddenly stand up and jump. And not just hobble along with canes and walkers, but jump and leap and run. And people marveled as they saw the blind, who had never seen a thing of the day in their lives, or at least had been without sight for a long time, suddenly be able to see clearly, and see perfectly. And these people then glorified the God of Israel. Some people say that that phrase then, at the end of verse 31, indicates that this might have been a bunch of Gentiles as well. And there would have been some in the area of Galilee, known as the Decapolis, where Jesus was at this time. At that time, after that had gone on for about 3 days, people bringing out, I mean, you see the massive claim that is made there in this writing? That a bunch of people from this area of Decapolis, 10 cities, had been bringing sick people to Jesus for 3 days and he'd been healing them, and nobody was disappointed. That's what the record claims. And then Jesus says to his disciples, "Come here. I have compassion on the multitude, for they've been with me these 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I do not want to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way." Jesus has a problem with a mass of people to feed again. The claim then here in Mark, both of which were written well before 70 AD, is that Jesus asks the disciples something about this. The disciples, he asks about what he should do with that, and the disciples said to him, "Where could we get enough bread that we should feed all this multitude?" Now, maybe they ought to know where they could get enough bread if they had been paying attention a few weeks ago or a few days ago on the other side of, or a little bit north on the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus had 5,000 men plus women and children. Here he has 4,000 men plus women and children. At that particular time, Jesus took 5 loaves of bread, sat the people down in 50s and hundreds, kept breaking bread, handing it to the disciples, who then kept handing it out to the people until everybody was full and they took up 12 baskets full of leftovers. The disciples now, faced with a similar situation, apparently don't remember that, and they say to Jesus, "Where are we going to get enough bread to feed these people?" So Jesus said to them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7 and a few little fish. So Jesus commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and he did just as before. He started breaking bread, handing it to the disciples. The disciples gave it to the multitude till everybody ate and everybody was full. And then they took up 7 large baskets full of leftovers. Arguably, that would be more than the leftovers of the first time because the baskets were so much larger. These are probably the size that a man could fit in if he stooped down. It's a miracle, claimed to have been witnessed by thousands of people. Sometimes the disciples forgot. Sometimes God's people forgot his ability. Sometimes God's people forgot exactly what he was able to do. And sometimes they complained. When the Israelites came up out of Egypt, the Old Testament records for us, in one of those other ages of miracles, which have been very few and very limited in the history of mankind, the people of Israel wondered how they would get water. And on one occasion, God had Moses strike the rock and water gushed out. On another occasion, prior to that, there were bitter waters that Moses was instructed to throw a tree into. And when he did, those waters were made sweet for the people to drink. And then the people wondered what they would eat. And God started providing with the dew of the morning for a couple of million people, we gather, bread that was on the ground, manna. The description of it, of which is recorded in Exodus chapter 17 and Numbers chapter 11. And then when the people weren't satisfied with that, they complained and said, "We should have stayed in Egypt and been slaves because we had fish to eat and cucumbers and melons and garlic and leeks and onions. And we don't have any meat out here. And God got upset with them in Numbers chapter 11 and said, you want meat? You'll have meat. And you eat meat not for one day, not for 2 days, not for 5 days, not for 10 days, not for 20 days, but for a whole month until, he said, it comes out your nostrils. You'll eat meat till it comes out your noses, God said. And they would. After Moses asked, God, what are you going to do? Kill all the flocks and sheep that we have enough meat to feed these people? What are you going to do? Gather together all the fish of the sea that we have enough meat to feed these people? This is Moses, the faithful leader who doubts God's ability at this time in Numbers chapter 11, verses 21 and 22. And then in verse 23, God rebukes Moses and says, has the Lord's arm been shortened? Really? You've cut off my power? Am I not able to do things for you anymore? After that, Moses looks and sees that there is quail that has landed on the land as far as he could see one way and as far as he could see another way and up to 2 cubits high or up to 3 feet high. And those people ate meat until they got sick. Jesus didn't always provide food for his disciples this way. In John chapter 4, you remember, he's talking with the Samaritan woman while the disciples went out to buy food. So these miracles were few and far between. And they weren't for the purpose of just making life easy for everybody. The disciples wonder then, how in the world are we going to get food here? Should they have really wondered? Jesus does not rebuke them at this time. He feeds the people, sends away the multitude, gets into the boat, and comes across the Sea of Galilee again to the northwest side, to the area of Magdala, or as Mark describes it, Dalmanutha. Then in chapter 16, the scribes and the Pharisees come again. Remember, they came to Jesus after the feeding of the 5,000 with a complaint. Now they come to Jesus after the feeding of the 4,000 with a request. Show us something. If you're the Son of God, show us a sign from heaven. Come on, show us something that proves that you're divine. Now, you wonder sometimes how thick people can be. You get an idea of it here. These people, these Pharisees and these Sadducees, two enemy groups that had bonded together for the political purpose of taking down Jesus, come and they ask for a sign from Jesus. He could have rightly said, how about the one I just did on the other side of the Galilee? Go ask those people. How about the woman that I healed that had a flow of blood for 12 years? How about the girl that I raised to life? How about the blind men that I caused to see? How about the couple of paralyzed men that I caused to stand up and walk? How about the leper that was instantaneously healed? He could have said all of that to them. Or he could have given them something. Maybe, some scholars have suggested, they're looking for something to come down direct from heaven, like Elijah brought fire from heaven on Mount Carmel. Or maybe they're looking for the sun to stand still, as it did for Joshua in a battle in Joshua chapter 10. They're looking for something. But I think they're disingenuous in their looking because they had plenty of evidence already. Therefore, Jesus says to them, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And when it is morning, you say, it will be foul weather, for the sky is red and threatening. Well, I got up this morning and looked out our back door, and there's a nice red, pretty sky, and I thought, well, that probably means the weather's going to get bad later today. It's not supposed to get horrible, but we are starting to get some precipitation. And we're kind of shielded from very, very bad storms with these hills. But imagine out on the ocean. Well, they paid attention to the sky. I'm out on the Sea of Galilee and on the shores of the Sea of Galilee where storms could whip up very quickly. They paid attention to the sky. And they knew that if you had a nice, beautiful sunset one evening and it was a red sky, that probably the next day it's going to be a nice day. And they knew from experience teaching them that the next morning, if the red sky was red, that probably there might be some storms that day. We say it, the way I heard it growing up was, red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky at morning, sailors take warning. I've also read it, red sky at night, shepherd's delight. Red sky at morning, shepherds take warning. People have known this throughout the ages. Jesus says, you know this. You are hypocrites because, then he says, You know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. You can read these physical things and tell you what the weather's going to be, but you're not understanding the great laws of nature that I'm breaking here to prove to you that I'm someone above nature, People want to argue with the Bible and say, oh, miracles don't happen. The laws of nature rule. That's the point of miracles, to say that the laws of nature rule except when someone from above nature comes. Someone from above nature was there, and he was there to prove himself. These Pharisees weren't satisfied with that. They wanted something else. Jesus said, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except the prophet Jonah. He said those words before in Matthew chapter 12 when they also asked for a sign. Prophet Jonah was in the belly of the great fish 3 days and three nights. The Son of Man would be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. That's all he was going to give them. He was saying the prophecy ought to be enough. The Pharisees and Sadducees were not people who wanted to have faith. I'm not saying that people should have faith just because they want it. Faith is not blind belief in something that is not provable. Faith is belief in something more based on the evidence that you see. Look around at the design in the universe, and you know, if you have any amount of common sense at all, that this didn't just happen by accident, by unguided chance. It had to be designed. That's reason. That's evidence. That's logic. And even though you can't see the one who did it, you know it. That's called faith. These Pharisees were rejected because they could read the signs of the laws of nature but would not admit to someone who was breaking the laws of nature. They wanted something different. Today, people want something different, I suppose. It's not enough for people to look back and see that these miracles were out in public for everybody to see, and people could invalidate them very quickly if they wanted to. Again, there comes the discussion. I was having it with my son the other night. Those people who want to start a false religion, all they have to do is claim a private miracle happened to them, claim they had some dreams, and they'll get some followers, sometimes millions of followers. But you see, these claims are different because these claims were made that thousands upon thousands of people saw these things done. And these books were published in that generation when those things would have been done. And those things would have been done, if they hadn't been done, those people wouldn't have accepted it. But Christianity grew like wildfire, knowing that something special had happened. That ought to be enough for people today that these things are written. You understand from reading the scriptures then that the miracles happened to prove that Jesus was the Son of God, John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, and to confirm that the apostles were sent by him, Mark chapter 16 and verse 20, and that these miracles would continue until that which was made perfect had come, the law of God, the New Testament. When that was complete, then those miracles would cease, 1 Corinthians 13, verses 8 through 13. And that ought to be enough for us to realize that the Christian religion is the true religion, that Jesus Christ is really the Son of God, and that his moral code and everything about him supersedes all others. It ought to be enough, but people still want something miraculous to happen today. They say, well, if I haven't seen it, it's not going to happen. And I don't know what kind of person would say anything like that, really, because there's so many things that happen in this universe that we all believe that even though we didn't see with our own particular eyes. And they say, some people who are of a religious bent will say, well, I'll believe if something happens to me, if I get some New Testament gift like they had, if I'm able to do some of the things I read about in the New Testament. We're wanting miracles like the Pharisees and Sadducees were wanting miracles. We're not happy with what you've done, Christ, they were saying. Give us something else. And that's the way a lot of people are today. We're not happy with what you've done. Give us something else. This passage teaches us, you see, that we come to God on his terms and not on ours, and his terms are plenty good enough. That applies to verifying the Christian religion all the way down to every command that is given in the Christian religion. The other day, you heard in the announcements, Scott Judge went up to a hospital where his uncle had been suffering for a long time with cancer and was in hospice care. He went to talk to this uncle, and this uncle desperately wanted to be baptized into Christ. And this uncle was bedfast. And the doctor was against it. And the nurses were against it. And the religious officials at the hospital were against it. And it would have been awfully easy for Scott to say, well, he wants to. That ought to be good enough. Surely God won't require this of him at this time. Would have been awfully easy for Scott to say that. A lot of people would have patted him on the back for saying that. But he persisted for about 8 hours until they finally found a way to get three men to hoist a man into a hospital spa and baptize him, and then get a hoist to lift him back up out and into his bed a day before he passed away. Why do you go to that much trouble? Because you want to do things on God's terms and not our own. It'd be easy for us to say, God, if you just show me this, I'll do what you want. Or if you just change your law a little bit for this particular moral situation, then I'll do what you want. Or if you just tweak things a little bit, or surely God wouldn't do that. No. We come to God on his terms, not ours. There's a lesson of humility that I need to remember, and might I suggest that our world needs to remember. We don't get to make up the codes of ethics and morals and law by which a person might obey God and go to heaven. God does that. He's the one who's proven himself. He's the one who sent his son. His son has proven himself. And his son went to the cross and resurrected from the dead and appeared to over 500 witnesses during a 40-day period. He gets to set the standards. After this incident, the disciples come to the other side of the Sea of Galilee again, over to the eastern side one more time. Either while they get across or after they get across, it appears from Matthew's record that it's after they get across, that Jesus says to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. You know what leaven is? We had a sermon on the parable of the leaven a while back. Leaven goes in bread and it causes it to rise slowly, almost imperceptibly. You don't see it happening, but it happens anyway. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The disciples didn't understand what he was talking about at first. You know what they thought? They thought it's because we've taken no bread. Oh no, we don't have any bread. Jesus rebukes them rather harshly. In Matthew, he says, oh, you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves because you have bought no bread? Now, should there be any reason for these disciples to not be concerned about food at this point? You would think, wouldn't you? Mark's gospel in Mark chapter 8 records Jesus' wording a little more sharply. He says to them something like this, if I can remember it correctly. Why are you worried about the loaves? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Are your hearts still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? That was phraseology that Jesus had used of the Pharisees before, and he's telling them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Then Jesus asked them a pointed question, the way it's recorded in Mark. When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full did you take up? They answered, probably sheepishly, 12. When I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full did you take up? Can you imagine how sheepish and quiet this answer would be when they answered, 7? Then Jesus said, probably like a frustrated parent, how is it that you do not understand? And then finally, they understood that he talked to them about the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees and not about bread. In other words, they shouldn't have been worried about bread. So you got some different examples here of faith and the lack of faith. Here's a Gentile woman in Tyre and Sidon area who has great faith, even though she doesn't even have the law of God. Here are 4,000 people who then are bringing their sick to Jesus, and he's healing them, and then he feeds them, and they go away. And then come the Pharisees and the Sadducees who want to see something miraculous. And then come the disciples who are supposed to be Jesus' friends and who are following him and who are really doing better than anybody else in Judea and Galilee right now. But they still don't get that the Lord has the power that he does. We live in a non-miraculous age. We don't need the miracles anymore. God works through his providence, don't get me wrong. I pray for people to get well. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Pray for God's will to be done. God works behind the scenes, but You don't see things like people walking on water and the raising of the dead anymore. Those were for a particular time, for a particular purpose, and if they happened all the time, well, they wouldn't be special, would they? Yet in this non-miraculous age, I still find that I kind of struggle like the disciples do. Well, God's got us through this crisis, and God's got us through this crisis, and God's got us through this trial, and God's got us through this circumstance, but oh no, here comes another one. What am I going to do? Kind of like the disciples. Well, we had 5,000 people, 5,000 men to feed. You fed them all, and we had 12 baskets full of leftovers. We had 4,000 men plus women and children to feed. You fed them all and had 7 baskets full of leftovers, but now we don't have any bread. What are we going to do? You ever find yourself like that? There's a crisis, there's a trial, there's a situation, there's trouble. God's been with you through a whole bunch of other stuff, but you think his hand probably won't be good enough for this one. That's where faith comes in. No, you haven't seen it done yet, but you know he's there, and you know he's worked in history, and you sense that perhaps he's worked in his providence, Philemon 1, verse 15. But yet we doubt that he can get us through what circumstances may come. He can. He will. If it's his will. And if our will doesn't match up with his will, guess what? His will be good enough. So we pray. So we seek. And so we press. God help us to have strong faith. I don't know where your faith is. If you've not expressed faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and been baptized for the remission of your sins, then according to the Scriptures, you're not really saved and in a right relationship with God yet. We'd love to help you to be if you'd let us know your need today. And if you've done that but you haven't been faithful to Him and you've been struggling and you've been maybe even denying Him, even on a public basis by your behavior or by your words, then you can repent and pray for forgiveness and He'll accept you back. If we could help you, would you please come as we stand and sing to encourage you?